Good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon. A really nice New Year's buzz in the dining room, but I think we're going to get started so we have plenty of time for questions and answers at the end of the session today. Happy New Year. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm with Thomson Reuters here in Hong Kong and the Board of Governors at the FCC. It's a pleasure to be here today to have Jaspal Bindra, the Asia CEO of Standard Chartered, with us at a very interesting time for the financial markets and also a crucial time for banking, the beginning of 2012. We saw the Hang Seng Index down 20% last year, concerns about the Eurozone and regulatory changes around the world. I asked a noted investor earlier this week whether he would stay in banking if he had the choice, and his answer was, "I think I'm going to go and become a farmer." Well, Jaspal Bindra has been in the banking business for over two decades. He's on the board of Standard Chartered since the year 2010. I asked him whether he would like to stay in the banking business this year, and he said he wanted to keep going. So we'll be interested to hear his remarks. Jaspal Bindra of Standard Chartered.
Thank you, Tara. A very happy new year to all of you. And the only reason I don't want to go to farming is it's too tough. You try farming in the winter, it's even tougher. It's my pleasure to be here today. And I would like to thank the Foreign Correspondents Club for this kind invitation at this beautiful venue and this wonderful lunch. For some of you who may not be entirely familiar with Standard Chartered, we are currently among the top 25 banks by market capitalization in the world. The number keeps changing every time you look at the screen as different banks keep slipping. We don't take too much triumph ourselves. We haven't done that much more, but a lot of others have slipped down, so we've moved up. We are headquartered in London, but 90% of our business is from the markets of Asia, Middle East, and Africa, both in terms of revenue and in terms of profit. I'm sure you will agree with me that the last 2 years have been unprecedented in many ways. And many people talk about what is different between 2008 and today. I think what happened in 2008 was distinctly different in the sense that it came as a big surprise. Nobody really expected Lehman's to fall over the keel, and they did, and you know that sort of led to all the crisis thereafter. In this current round, you know, we saw it gradually coming. We saw 2009 as a bad year. We saw 2010 recover. The first half of 2011 was very promising, and then it sort of started filtering back again in the second half of 2011 downwards. But it came with huge amount of guidance and preparation this time, unlike last time. The big difference this time is that last time it was the financial institutions who were down, but they had the backstop of the governments to put in the TARP and to put in all the other support. This time it's the sovereigns who have sort of curved in, and you know it's quite difficult to see where the stop is. And it reminds me of a cartoon, and you know, obviously, no favoritism here, and no offense meant, but you know, a cartoon that I saw in the FT, which had said, you know, where next? You know, the banks have failed, the governments don't have the supporting capacity. You know, the next stop has to be Mars, and you know, so it is kind of quite challenging from that perspective. And so all the things that we saw in 2011, which was the tumbling of the global markets, the wild foreign exchange moves, the acute risk aversion from the banks, the crumbling of the global sentiment across the world, and the contraction of credit markets are likely to continue and to remain of major concern to all of us in 2012. We think the Europe's debt crisis and the apparent economic paralysis in America may seem quite far away from how things are in Asia, but they are likely to stay that way, at least in the first half of 2012. The very feeble economic environment in the West continues to pose potential for a global shock, both to economic growth and prosperity. So I think we will always be mindful, between the Americas and Europe and Japan put together is more than 75% of the global GDP. So it's difficult to have a situation where that doesn't have the kind of impact that one might see if things were to go seriously wrong there. And what has been unfortunate in the last 6 months in the euro area is that all the policy moves that have come out of the euro area have failed to calm market nervousness. The backstop mechanisms which have been announced so far are either too limited, which have come from IMF, et cetera, or they lack credibility. The European Stability Financial Stability Fund doesn't have the credibility, or they are simply not ready, like the European Stability Mechanism. So given that situation, the European leaders will need to agree on a far more concrete plan, which we hope in the series of meetings that have been planned over the next few weeks, culminating in a final summit in March 2012, will at least give sufficient direction, if not a complete solution, towards that move. The sovereign debt concerns will continue to hound, not just in the southern periphery of Europe, but increasingly across northern Europe as well, including France, where its AAA rating is now at risk. Whilst the most likely scenario, we still believe, is that the euro will muddle through in the context of this heightened tension. But the big issue, we think, is that recessionary growth will still be on its own a big issue. So, even if we can keep the solvency of Europe and the euro as a currency intact, how do they come out of, get back to growth is going to be really on its own independent challenge and a big one. And any policy misstep or any inaction or any other blunder from a governance point of view will pose a huge additional risk to the outlook of on Europe that we are foreseeing right now. Obviously, this crisis is affecting the East as well. We cannot be immune to the events, but what we can say is we are far more insulated and the East is far more resilient. So in some ways, 2012 for the East is likely to be an extension of 2011. The growth among Asian economies is expected to decelerate in 2012, partly driven by the stagnation in the West. And while policy tightening in the Asian markets that's been happening over 2010 and 11 is likely to take effect into most part of 2012, adding to that deceleration. Exports are likely to lead Asia's slowdown. Domestic demand, especially in export-oriented economies, will soften as job and income growth slow or even contract temporarily. However, the good news is that inflation is expected to take a backseat among a weaker growth environment in Asia, which was really the big bug through most of 10-11 and had the potential to create some bubbles which could risk the economies in Asia. That seems to be far more controlled going forward. Given all of this, both in the West and in Asia, one message might be that do not be surprised by anything. This is now like I'm speaking like an economist. And do not underestimate anything. This uncertainty, which is surrounding the euro area, but it's not limited alone to the euro area, may contribute to volatility. In fact, we are certain it will contribute to volatility and risk aversion, at least for the early parts of 2012, before the markets return their focus to growth agenda. And that almost necessarily has to be driven by the emerging markets of Asia. So clearly, there's a lot hinging on Asia, but it might take its duration. And in the meantime, the world is going to remain quite uncertain and volatile. The operating environment of business in Asia is likely to remain challenging as a result. A combination of weaker orders from the West, still tight credit conditions, and cautious hiring sentiment could only become far more prominent in 2012. So what does this suggest for the near to medium term? Europe's economic woes remain a threat to Asia, but there are opportunities for banks in Asia to expand and fill the gap. The euro crisis will force European banks and maybe even some US banks that have large operations in Europe to retreat from Asia, posing threat to short-term liquidity and growth. But this will provide opportunities for Asian banks to step in to meet the shortfall created by the pullback from the European banks into this region. The global economic growth could slow as financing becomes less available or more expensive. Yet Asia should fare better given less pressure to deleverage. Weaker demand in the West will prompt Asian economies to drive harder for regional and South-South growth, which may support Asian banks to go regional or at least spread across emerging markets. This should help offset some of the cyclical effects from the global downturn in the growth, which is really the volatile asset market, the higher non-performing loans, and weaker merchandise trade flows into the West. Ratings of emerging market banks should perform better, while that of mature markets will definitely suffer. This is more a correction of the previous rating bias. And so in some ways, it is the logical direction to move. Looking ahead, global banking regulatory environment will get even tougher, irrespective of how the crisis unfolds. I think the regulators have got the bug going. They've got enough justification for what they are going towards. And so irrespective of the time and the pace at which things change, we can be sure about the regulatory environment getting far more difficult and intrusive. The Asian banks, which are on a much more stronger footing structurally than banks from other region, should be able to weather better because of their strong fundamentals, particularly the balance sheets being strong. The banks from this region remain well capitalized, their asset quality is fundamentally sound, their funding bases are not highly dependent on foreign funding, their earning generation capacity is good. So unlike their peers in other countries, Asian banks are very much in growth mode rather than deleveraging mode. Some may even gain from the loss of their European Western counterparts. And I surely hope Standard Chartered is in that category. I would like to stress that Asian banks, including international banks like Standard Chartered, didn't run leveraged business models, stayed clear of overly complex products and focused on customers they knew well. They never lost sight of the basic disciplines of banking, of managing liquidity, risk, and capital. The key reason is not because we know better, but largely because we've had our own financial crisis to learn from in the late 90s. And the lessons learned from that painful experience have protected the Asian banks this time. After the slightly on the contrary, the West policymakers or the policymakers in the West have been grappling with ways to avoid another crisis and are rushing through new controls on financial institutions as the only mantra to be able to save taxpayers' money being burned the next time around. In summary, the full gamut of regulatory changes currently in motion across the globe needs to be implemented in a coordinated and globally consistent way across all banks and all geographies, to learn from each other's positives and misfortunes and adopt the best practices going forward would be the need of the hour. All that said, it is also vital to keep a longer term perspective in mind when viewing Asian banks' prospects for the year ahead. In particular, we see the European crisis as a catalyst to the structural rise of emerging markets within the global economic arena. In fact, this is not just an emergence for the first time, this is the re-emergence of where the economic powers lay for centuries, for several hundreds of years, thousands of years, if I'm to be correct, till 200 years ago. and then it lost to the West, and now it's just sort of correcting itself to some extent. Post-crisis, we have clearly seen a shift in economic gravity from the West to the East. In 2000, and I think it's almost certain for 2011, although I haven't seen the numbers yet, more than 70% of the world growth came from Asia and other emerging markets. There is every likelihood that this will remain the case in the year ahead as well. Some of the underlying drivers of the world economy is set to remain undeterred by the troubles in the West, and I would like to list a few that would justify why Asia will continue to grow relative to itself a little bit more moderately, but far in excess of where the West has been even in its, at its best. The first is the growth of consumer markets across emerging world as a middle class expands, helped by rising incomes and growing populations. And I would also add to that that the penetration of almost anything per capita, from use of steel to the consumption of coke to the use of financial service industry, is at its lowest per capita in the emerging markets. So clearly there's huge room for growth. The second is emerging economies moving up the value curve with increased investment and higher infrastructure spending. China is a classic example. You know, when you buy an iPod made in China worth $170, the value contribution from China is only $10 in that. The rest goes to Japan, Taiwan, Apple, etc. And you know, it's now very seemingly possible, as China is determined, to build a $40 to $50 contribution into that product, as among a host lot of other things. The third is rapid urbanization across many emerging economies. And the examples are rife for all the big economies, be it Indonesia, be it China, be it Vietnam, be it India. I'll just give you the India statistic. There are 350 million people who live in urban locations today. That is expected by 2050 to be at least 650 million. So that's the pace of urbanization. It's no different for China and Indonesia. The growth in new trade corridors reflecting increased flow of goods, commodities, remittances, and portfolio, as well as direct investments. And you know, the China-Africa trade corridor is one very good such example, but there are several, depending on which sectors you choose to focus on across the emerging markets. And lastly, the increasing importance of China to the global economy and the rising visibility of the renminbi, the offshore renminbi market. So there will be a continuation in 2012 of a two-speed world with a fragile West and a resilient East, which we've talked about for quite some time now. And so with that, I would like to conclude, ladies and gentlemen, with saying that Euro crisis is impacting Asian economies and the region is not immune to the events in the West, but Asia is fundamentally strong and is expected to outperform relative to other regions. But growth will be below potential in 2012, as negative spillover from the West will remain evident for a little while longer. Taking a longer term view, the West is facing a lost decade, just like we saw two happen in Japan, and the East is the new growth engine. So it's a fragile West and a resilient East, and it's vital to keep this in mind while viewing prospects for the years ahead. And despite a likely lower level of trade and investment activities between the West and the East in 2012, there remain huge opportunities for the banks in Asia to expand and take advantage of the deleveraging process as a result of the sovereign debt crisis on bank funding. The key is for emerging markets to work and develop closer together. It is important that we strike a balance in making the financial system safer whilst encouraging banks to do their job as a custody of assets, as an economic multiplier, as a conduit for job creation and economic growth. Thank you.
Thanks very much. We have plenty of time for questions and answers. So if you want to raise your hand and also give us your name and organization, who'd like to go first? Kelvin So from Reuters in the back, and then I'll come to Bloomberg second.
Hi, just follow. It's Kelvin from Reuters. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Kelvin.
You mentioned deleveraging a bit earlier, and I'm just a bit concerned about that because there's a lot of talk about European banks deleveraging here in Asia. Is there any evidence that they have already started pulling out of loan syndicates, for example? And what opportunities does that present for Standard Chartered then if these European banks start pulling out of loan syndicates here in Asia?
I think, it's all driven by the need for increasing capital and capital ratios due to the new regulatory environment, which most European and Western banks are short of compared to where they're required to be. And they really have two choices. They can either raise equity from the markets, as UniCredit Bank is currently doing, and we're seeing that's quite difficult to do. The alternative is to shrink the balance sheet. So clearly people will do a mix of both. And I think we are seeing some early signs of that happening. It's happening a lot back home in the markets they belong to, but some of it is happening in Asia as well. But very early days still. Well, we hope a couple of things. I mean, there's a broader point there which I'll make, which is as European banks withdraw due to a couple of reasons. One is the dollar liquidity constraint, US dollar liquidity constraint, and secondly, because of the need to deleverage just the total size of the balance sheet. It does create openings for two things. One is for market share for Standard Chartered, as well as for increasing price margin. So I think we are seeing some of that happen already in across many of our markets. We're trying to capitalize on that.
Mr. Bindra, Douglas Wong from the board and from Bloomberg. You talked about very compellingly about how Asia is now the growth engine and the resilient part of the world economy and how the West is fragile and almost history. And you talked also about how Standard Chartered is an Asian bank. Why are you headquartered in London? Why don't you come home?
Firstly, I do want to be very clear that the West is still a very big part of the world economy. So I think there's just a correction happening, and that for the next decade, just like Japan still remains as a very big economy in the world, so will Europe and America. But I think there's going to be a correction for Asia over the next 10 years or so. We are home. Asia is our home. This is where we make more than two-thirds of our income and profit. We're just home. It's just, we don't want to be... We have some big benefits of having grown in Asia. If we were to start today, we would probably have started here, but we started there and served us well. There is really no immediate reason. But given all the pressure we get from the media and from everyone else about other stakeholders about why we are based in London, I can assure you that we are looking at it all the time at the board, and if and when there is sufficient reason. It's not a decision you take lightly because you don't move headquarters every so often. It's something you do with at least the hope that you'll be at the next place for the 50 or 100 years. And it's very difficult to predict which part of the world will be worse off or better off in the next 50 to 100 years.
Over here. A microphone up front, please.
Jane Singer with Inside Fashion. Of all the emerging nations within Asia, I mean, obviously China is poised for growth, and because of its size, there's a lot of attention focused on it. Are there other, within all the nations that you see as growing, are there others that you see as particular standouts that you feel have underlying stability and that you feel have a long growth possibility, long stable growth?
I think the Asian markets that have large domestic markets are all in that category, China obviously being way ahead because it's not only got a large domestic economy, but it's also got huge financial resources to back that up. India would have only one of those two conditions satisfied, not the second. But Indonesia is another very good example of a large domestic economy. So I would say that's definitely one category. The second category are the two hubs in Asia, which is Hong Kong and Singapore, which you know, for a long time people have said have been mature markets and can't grow. And I think if you see the Standard Chartered results alone, we've been growing double digit and very high double digits in the 20%+ in both these markets over the last several years. So clearly there is growth, not just from the market alone, but because of its hub status. And then there are the smaller economies, but which probably are the markets for a few decades later, which we have to sow in now. And Vietnam would be one very good one in that category.
Right back here.
Renita Malhotra-Hora from RTHK. Hi. So you mentioned that this year, 2012, we're looking at volatility and risk aversion, which seems to be sort of the opinion across the board. Yet the growth opportunities are with the Asian banks. So given that, will a bank like Standard Chartered actively build out its investment banking and equities, you know, use the opportunity to do so?
Yeah, I think two things to that question. One is that, you know, we have looked at our wholesale business always through the lens of our clients. And we have expanded our product range quite broadly over the last 10 years. And the most recent of them being our investment banking and in particular the equities business within that. So for us, it is more a response to what the clients want. We don't do equities business as a standalone to new customers. And for that reason, we don't have our own research, et cetera. We just want to do sufficient that the clients will be able to get all their services under one roof. And so for that reason, as long as part of our, it fits the client need strategy, it will remain a big and a growing part of our franchise. But we are never going to become, or we don't have an aspiration to become an investment bank per se. We do want to be a very solid commercial bank with the product capability for investment banking.
Francis?
Francis Moriarty, also of RTHK. This morning on one of the business programs on television, someone referred to Burma as perhaps a future dragon in Asia. What is your outlook for the possibilities in Burma?
We think Burma is very quickly going off the sanction list of both the United States and UK, which is the only reason why we are not in Burma, the only two markets in Asia we don't operate in are North Korea and Burma. We used to be in Burma for a long time, and we'll be very happy to get back there. And I think, you know, we are foreseeing, you know, if I was a betting man, I would say in 2012, Burma will be off the sanctions list and it will be a place. Whether it becomes a dragon economy or not is difficult to foresee, you know, right from here. But clearly, it will be in the category of Vietnam, where it will have huge future potential.
We had a question back here.
Hi, this is Stephanie from Bloomberg News. You know, the Taiwan election is upcoming. So how do you see that? Will that add to risk to investors interested in the island? Or how do you see the tie between China and Taiwan? Would that aggravate, or how would that like change the risk appetite of investors into the island? And the second question is, in addition to the challenges that you mentioned just now, what are the other factors inside in the region that may add to risk of investors? For example, like with inflation or other potential domestic issues in the region that investors need to be aware of? Thank you.
Okay. On Taiwan, obviously we'll have the results very soon. We are only a week or so away from the results of the elections. Our sense is that irrespective of whether Ma from the KMT comes back into power or we have the DPP come into power, you know, the equation with China has been set. I think from an economic incentivization, there's a very strong feeling among the business community in Taiwan that that can only progress one way. The pace of it might vary a little bit, but broadly, we foresee that irrespective of the political outcome, we are going to see a far stronger economic bonding between the mainland and the states of Taiwan. In terms of what could go wrong for investors, clearly inflation is going to be less of a worry in 2012 than it was in 2011. However, the overall export growth is going to be probably the bigger worry in 2012 over 11.
We have a question here.
Hi, Dr. Jain, private dentist, member FCC. I just wanted to ask, you acknowledge and most people acknowledge that Asia is where the action is. So why are the European banks retreating? They should be coming here in droves where things are so dire there. I mean, they should follow where the money is, where the action is. That seems to be logical.
Absolutely. No, it is logical, and it is what they would like to do. And if you saw what was happening through the second half of 2010, even into the first half of 2011, you would have noticed that the European banks were really bulking up in Asia. I mean, you know, I recently met with the BBVA people, and they were sort of really rolling out hundreds of jobs and big offices and everything. So clearly that was happening. But now I don't think so. It's that they've lost their faith or their confidence in the potential of Asia. It's just that the overall challenge in terms of keeping their capital afloat or their balance sheet at the same level is where the challenge is. So I think the immediate will be to just shore that up to meet the regulatory requirement, and then I think they are coming. They're coming.
We had a question over here, and then Keith, I haven't forgotten you, I promise.
Robin Fox, I'm an associate. How's the implementation of the UK Bribery Act going? Have you lost any business to other banks who are not covered by it?
It is quite a challenging act for some of you who are not aware of what it is, but it makes it even more difficult to implement in a non-UK kind of environment because there are just so many things that are accepted as normal in the way of life. Fortunately for the Bribery Act, I think a lot of it is being driven by guidance to be trying to do the right thing. And I think there is going to be, we are in that process because it's very early in the enactment of the act. And to the extent that we can do things that are not special dispensations to the company, but available to all, that sort of gets excluded. And secondly, when you pay for things which are post-service rendered, they get. So I think there are categories of how to fit and implement that, but it is a challenge. We're working hard towards it. As far as documentation, et cetera, is concerned, we are taking all the care we can. I think, you know, right now, I wouldn't say that we've lost any business. It's just added a little bit more extra work and a little bit more of a mindset change.
Keith?
Keith Bradshaw, New York Times. How vulnerable are the banks in China on to the deflation of the real estate bubble there? Maybe not through the mortgages themselves, since those seem to have very large down payments, but through loans to industrial companies that have speculated in real estate and to real estate developers themselves.
Yeah, I think you know, most of the balance sheet out to Chinese users in the banking industry, outside of the banking industry, have been from the large Chinese banks. So to a great extent, what goes into SOE is a left pocket, right pocket kind of balance. If you look at the private sector banks, which are really the foreign banks in China, you would see that most of them have concentrated on areas which haven't been well served by the large local Chinese banks. And SMEs being a very clear example, certain product groups in terms of wealth management, et cetera, being another example. So I think the real exposure for the foreign banks in China is not as skewed towards either the property or to the SOEs. I mean, I'll give you our example. Our total China loan book is less than 5% of our total book. I think our wholesale bank, our wholesale bank exposure, 75% of it is less than 1 year. And our mortgage book has a loan to value of around 44%. So, you know, I mean, I don't think so. It's such a challenge for the foreign banks. It's a bigger issue I would believe that the other foreign banks are in the same kind of situation as we are.
We had a question over here, and then we'll wind up here.
John Antweiler from Wells Fargo Bank. Thank you for your comments this afternoon. I feel like I've learned a lot. Question for you, though. You have talked about the growing wave of regulation, and in fact, you said that we really do need global regulation, and that is a necessary thing to happen for banking. So I guess the question I ask is this driving banking, including Standard Chartered and Wells Fargo, into sort of a utility business where higher returns are not possible? And I'm wondering if you could comment on the potential for growth for non-banks, whether they're venture capital, private equity, hedge funds, those sorts of things.
Sure. I think first thing first, clearly the regulations were allowing a certain degree of efficiency, which is now being eliminated because of the new requirements. And that will put a strain on some of the earning potential and earning capacity. Having said that, I mean, if you look at the Asian banks, they were always operating at more than 10% of Tier 1 capital. And so for them, it's not a new situation. It's just that banks in the West were allowed to operate at 6% or less even. And they are finding that challenge of bringing it back to 10 quite difficult. So in some ways, I would say if the Asian banks were able to generate good income with 10% capital ratio, you know, there's no reason why the Western banks, who've been at it longer, who far more sophisticated, etc., should not be able to find ways of being earning accretive at the same rates as they were before. But in the immediate term, there will be a challenge on the return, because as the delta of the base grows up, you know, the arithmetic just won't work. But I think over the medium term, there is no reason to believe that that won't happen. I mean, we've had, you know, we raised our capital early 2 years ago, and we did one tranche 2 years ago, one about 18 months ago, and we've still shown record performance. So I don't see any reason for that to be a perennial challenge. Obviously, the rates will sort of moderate for a bit, and then hopefully as the capital matures and puts into full use, then you should get the return back. Because I think the big bet is the world going to be growing? Is the world going to be wealthy? Is there going to be enough economic activity around in the world? And the answer is yes to most of them. Once you have that answer, then you have to believe that banking will be an essential conduit. I think some of the things that were being abused in terms in a sort of a passive regulatory environment in some economies is how I would say it. It's like when you're driving on the highway, you know, you always have a speed limit, but most of us don't sort of adhere to it till you get caught by the cop and then pay up. And I think that's what was happening with the banks, that, you know, they were sort of thriving at a higher speed than they needed to because there was a passive regulatory environment. And that might go a little bit heavy, as I suggested, but so it might have some dislocation. But eventually, I think the markets are there. There is activity to be made money in. If the banks are solid on their balance sheet, they have the momentum, they have the client relationships, you know, it's going to happen. The business is there to happen. I have no reason to believe that we're going to become a utility in the sense that, yes, we will be more regulated than we were before, so that's closer to a utility. But we've always been in a regulated environment. You know, in some countries, the regulations have been quite strenuous. And the returns will be moderate in the near term because of the sudden increases in capital that all of us are having to make, but no justification for that being a perennial problem. And as long as people make more money and have growth, then people should get paid. May not be at the stupid levels that some of you might think bankers do, but you know, I think there will be remuneration which will be much higher than a kind of a utility job. So I think net-net, my prediction is that there will be shortage of commercial vanilla banking in the world. There will be shortage in China for sure. You know, the last 10 years has seen a lot of absorption of young Chinese talent into the banking world who are as good as it gets anywhere else in the world. But there's a gap between the 10-year and the 25-year experience. There just wasn't any banker around who did banking in the way we all understand it in the developed world. And so that gap, you know, the banking industry is just going to grow two or three times bigger in the next 10, 15 years. And that gap is not going to be there to fill. And the young guys are just 5-10 years into their career. So I would just say that's just one example. But it's no different. I mean, you know, India added 8 new bank licenses in the last 10 years. And the best banks in India today are the ones that got added in the last 10 years. The HDFC Bank, ICICI Bank, Axis Bank, et cetera. So, you know, I mean, there is a huge amount of appetite for banking services just because as we grow from 7 to 9 billion, as there's more wealth in the country, there's more activity, you know, there will be. So I'm not doom and gloom for banking. So I genuinely believe I'd rather be a banker than a farmer.
We have time for one last quick question.
Hi, Steve Hardacre from Chikara Leadership Consulting. My question is how you see Japan with all of the opportunities and certainly lots of problems with disasters, economic stagflation, and you know even the situation in Thailand where so many Japanese factories are based. And then you have them reaching out to ASEAN and China. How do you see all of that?
I think two things likely out of Japan. One is that they're clearly realize the need to diversify. So they are sort of moving out of their concentration into China. You know, they've got too much investment to China. They are gradually but surely diversifying back. They've had a few bad entry experiences in various Asian countries, Indonesia, etc. But I think they're revisiting all of those again. I think that's a good thing because, you know, they were sort of limited. But the big challenge for Japan still is when will they open up Japan? And I think that is really, at least they've got to a point where they're now talking about it. It was taboo subject till recently. Now at least they're talking about it. But how quickly we'll get there is anyone's guess. Difficult to say. But if you look at everything that's going on in Japan, you have to believe that they have to open up. If you just see the aging population, I mean, who's going to take care of? I mean, there is going to be in the next 10 years less productive people than not productive. I mean, they'll still be very rich, but they're not productive. So who's going to take care of their nursing and, you know, we will need dentists and we will need everyone else to take care of them. So I think Japan will in some shape or guise open up. And I think that will be the mantra for Japan to revive and come back. Okay.
It's 2:00. Thanks to everybody for coming. And Jaspal Bindra, thanks very much for your comments today.
No, my pleasure. I just wanted to once again thank the FCC for hosting this lunch. And very happy to be here this afternoon and having had this chance to interact at a distance but with all of you. I do want to say that as far as closing line on Standard Chartered is that we feel very blessed that through the crisis, that's the last 4 years since it began, we've got rated upwards by all the three rating agencies in the world, which no other international bank has achieved. But more importantly, that you know, Hong Kong continues to be our leading market. This is where we always were as our home. It will always be our home, and it will be our Greater China will be our biggest play going into the future. Thank you.